Pulling back the curtain on the world of high-end restaurants. One of the most talked-about books of the summer is Stephanie Dandler's debut novel, Sweet Bitter, which is set in a fictional famous restaurant in New York City. The characters are the employees of the restaurant, the servers, the bartenders, the chef, the managers. It depicts a high-stress, hard-partying, and highly sensual world. It's been hailed as a coming-of-age story that reflects a growing subculture, the people behind the foodie explosion. I'm Jennifer Rooks, today on Main Calling, what it's like to be immersed in the world of restaurants, the food and the service, not just in New York, but also here in Maine. Our guests are the author of Sweet Bitter, Stephanie Dandler, as well as acclaimed chef Sam Hayward and author Kate Christensen. Main Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Main Calling. When the novel Sweet Bitter burst onto the literary scene, everybody wanted to know the backstory of author Stephanie Dandler. It's her debut novel, and it paints a vivid picture of a young woman coming of age while working in a high-end New York City restaurant. She joins us from Argot Studios in New York City, and with me in the studio, two others, Kate Christensen and Sam Hayward. Kate is a Maine-based author of several novels and two food-centric memoirs, Blue Plate Special and How to Cook a Moose. Sam Hayward, of course, award-winning chef and co-owner of Portland restaurants 4th Street and Scales. As always, we want to hear from you. Did you ever work in the food service industry? If so, what were the best and worst parts of your job? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Main Calling, or post to the Main Calling Facebook page. Stephanie, congratulations on the runaway success of your novel. I saw online movie stars recommending it, Emma Roberts and you at a bookstore. How exciting.
Yeah, it has been a very surreal ride. I will definitely say that.
So what compelled you to write about this subject? And what do you hope that people get out of your story?
So when I went back to graduate school, I had the idea that I wanted to tell a female coming of age story. And I'd been in the restaurant industry since I was 15 years old. And at that point, I'd been in it in New York exclusively for 7 years. And so maybe it was laziness, but I had this expertise in this world, a world that I found endlessly fascinating. And I sort of married the two, the coming of age and the restaurant, with that first sentence, you will develop a palate. Once I hit on the idea of a palate, that this girl would develop her tastes, not just for food and wine, but for what it meant to be a young woman in New York City, then the novel kind of exploded from there. I mean, it's been in many incarnations, but that was when I knew I had something.
And I know you've probably been asked this a million times, how closely do the characters resemble the characters that you've known, the people you've known in the restaurant industry? Could you name, and I'm not going to ask you to here, but could you name each of them and give them their real names if you had to?
Oh, no. No, not at all. It's deeply fiction. I've been working in this business since I was a girl. And so even the restaurant that I write about is modeled physically on Union Square Cafe. But I took so much liberty to put in every restaurant I've ever worked at and every old bartender I've known or wisecracking busboy and all the disgusting things I've seen and all the beautiful food I've eaten. I kind of got to pull from everywhere and create a composite, which I think is so much richer than if I were just to write about my own experience. Also, it's more interesting, honestly.
Sam Hayward, reading Sweet Bitter, do you recognize the characters in the novel?
That's a tough question. But I do think that everybody I know that's read the book has asked the question, I wonder how autobiographical this really is. We all had the same response to it. But by the way, it's a terrific book, Stephanie. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for reading it.
Sam, you don't strike me as the kind of chef that's portrayed in this restaurant. Actually, before I have Sam talk about what it means to be the executive chef, Stephanie, why don't you tell our audience, if they have not read your novel, about the chef in the novel?
Oh, he is very talented. Can I leave it at that? I find that
passionate.
Chefs, yes, passionate. That's what we'll call it. Chefs are often artists, creative geniuses, and they often have the kind of emotional overflow that accompanies that kind of creativity. And so I've always held them to a different standard. I think that some people might find the chef in the novel to be rather intense or perhaps a bit aggressive, but I've always had so much respect for what they do, and I think that the character in the novel does as well, that they can really get away with anything. They're making magic.
Okay, now I'll ask Sam Hayward. There's some screaming and profanity and insults.
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah.
I'm shocked. I'm totally shocked.
I've known you not well, but for a while, Sam Hayward, I cannot imagine you like that.
Well, I have to say that
Please be honest, chef.
I'll try. I'd like to think that I mellowed over time. I had my years when I was, if not really feeling that kind of aggression and intensity, at least I was affecting it. but I've kind of let go of that over time, I think. That's just not who I am. And I don't really want to live that way, and I don't want my staff to feel like they have to live under that kind of oppression. I think that can be kind of a grim atmosphere to work in, and I don't think people do their best under that. We live in Maine. We're not in New York. We can do things differently from other places, and that's one of the things that I've looked toward.
All right, Kate Christensen, this is so fun to have you on the program because you straddle both of these, all three of these worlds, really. You've worked in the restaurant world in New York City. You're a Maine-based author now, so you know about what it takes to write about food. And I'm wondering how difficult it is to capture the visceral, sensual world of food and restaurants and the people who are just living it every day.
First, I should say that my experience in the food industry in New York was limited to one very unsuccessful, that's a mild understatement, stint as a waitress at a restaurant on the Upper East Side that had about 5 people for each lunch, and I managed to forget something for every table. So I was a terrible waitress. So I read this book, and I cooked at an all-night diner right after college in Portland, Oregon. So I'm really kind of an outsider in the restaurant industry. And I have written about food, and I love reading about food. And so as someone who loves eating in restaurants and reading and writing about food, I came to this novel with a lot of curiosity about what it takes to be a good waitress, having been such a bad one. And I was riveted. I found Stephanie, I loved this book, as you know, because I said so on the back.
Yes, you did.
And and one of the things I really loved about it is the way you start with the palate, and you make it about a coming of age, and it's really about, I mean, I thought about the way babies put things in their mouths to orient themselves in the world, to learn about the world. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Tess is learning who she is and learning what the world is. And New York, it takes place in New York, but it felt universal to me, a way of first and foremost educating yourself emotionally about your own appetites, about what you want and who you are. And it's sort of wedded, to get back to the idea of being a waitress and the restaurant industry, I found it interesting, the whole notion that you bring up of the 51% and the idea of character as it relates to the palate, and that it's not enough just to be able to taste, but you are serving. And so those two things together, to me, made a riveting, riveting story and an exploration of people and the way that it's rooted in food and character, not in an abstract way, but in a way of storytelling. I mean, I could not stop turning pages reading this book, and it never felt abstracted or pretentious, and my antenna are way out for that. I love the scene when she eats her first oyster, and around her everyone's sort of, you know, babbling words like, well, it's creamy, oh, it's briny, and somebody, and I think Jake is the one who identifies it. And she's mm-hmm. just like, what is this thing on my tongue? She's never eaten an oyster before. And that scene to me sort of encapsulates the book. It's sort of like she is learning to taste, but she's also learning about the world.
So this, I'm glad you brought up that passage, Kate, because I want to somehow get all of you to talk about this whole idea of the intense sensual pleasure of food and the way our culture today talks about food. And to some, you know, we're in so deep and we get so excited about certain kinds of wines and oysters and cheeses that it's so exciting. And then to others, the whole thing is just absurd. You know, we're talking about a meal. And there's a little bit of that, Stephanie, in your book. But is that something you think about a lot? This on the one hand, it's, you know, it can be an experience that's nirvana. On the other hand, it's lunch.
Right. And there, she's always walking that line. It is something I think about all the time personally. And I think we live in a time that obviously fetishizes and has a food obsession as a culture. And I think that there is a point when you're learning when you really need to know the jargon, where you really need to know the language. And then you really need to know the form, like, oh, I should talk about wine this way with these kinds of words. But I find, and I hope that you all agree with me, that once you reach real mastery of something, that's when it gets back to pure enjoyment. That's when people can say, wine is just part of a meal, or it's just dinner, and you come back to the simplicity. But only after you've gone to that, like, esoteric edge do you pull back.
Sam, thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, when I first read your comment that it's only dinner there, it reminded me of one of the servers who had been at 4th Street for many years, who's since gone on to work at Primo in Rockland, who got a letter at the restaurant from somebody who couldn't just say my hanger steak was overcooked. She attacked our integrity. She attacked my own personal character. The letter was scathing, and it was so absurd and over the top that we thought, this person is imbalanced. And I remember shrugging and saying to the staff that were listening to this, good grief, it's only dinner.
Yeah.
And Justin took that comment, turned it into a mantra, and then put it on a T-shirt that we wore. So it's only dinner became kind of emblematic of how absurd our conversation about food and whether or not we make mistakes. Are we human? What's happening in the kitchen? How absurd all of that could really be. It was very funny.
Well, and this is international. You look at the obsession with the Michelin stars.
Exactly.
and what goes into this. I mean, the amount of media attention and now in Maine, you know, a whole travel industry is growing around. And Sam, you're kind of, I know you didn't mean to take it this direction, but the 4th Street was really one of the first.
And even so, you could, well, thanks for saying that. I wish I could say that was completely true, but go to Yelp anytime, the website that includes...
Don't go to Yelp.
Well,
no, one, no one ever go to Yelp.
And Stephanie, you're correct. I never go there. But if you do, and one of the reasons I don't go is because you just see the absurd extent to which people go to impugn the integrity and intentions of people in the restaurant business. It's upsetting. So we all hate it. We just hate it.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, and as a when I was managing restaurants, I would not respond to that. It's actually really interesting publishing a novel now because I have the same mentality, which is everyone wants to cast their vote, and there's so much space for negativity on the internet, and it's sad that that's often how it comes out. But you can't feed that noise ever.
I agree.
And especially Yelp with restaurants, it's just not. Food is so much context, and it's always changing, and you can't make a definitive statement because you had one overcooked steak. It drives me mad.
People get very emotional about food. I think it taps into something deep and visceral in us. The desire to be fed, the desire to be taken care of, community, and now it's their aesthetic components. And this country, in my lifetime, when I was little, nobody paid attention to food. I mean, I think Julia Child was just beginning her reign to change the face of food in America. But I think it's become this sort of, first of all, there are class questions that always come up with food.
Of course.
And second, there are the emotional questions. And there's this feeling that you pay a lot for a meal, and food is expensive. And there's this idea that there is an exchange with food. With it's almost like going to the theater now, or seeing an opera. It's a cultural experience. It's a aesthetic experience. There's all these things that are wrapped up in a restaurant meal that make it so complicated. And I think Yelp sort of reflects more of the underbelly of that experience. And but I really feel like it's something that it's tapping into that is that this novel really gets at, which is the entire experience of the restaurant meal from start to finish.
And, you know, one of the things, Stephanie, in your novel, they're polishing and repolishing some of the glasses at one point because they're not good enough. Sam, do you feel this, like, pressure to be perfect all the time? Does your staff feel as though we can't have a spot on this wine glass? You know.
Well, we try to approach that in a reasonable way. It's kind of a rustic restaurant in some ways. So, but yes, we do polish glassware. You'll see before the wine glasses go to the table, you'll see the server hold it up to the light and make sure that it's clean. Yeah, we're very concerned about those details. Those details mean a lot. And it's the attention that we pay to those details that elevate one restaurant over another. And that includes in the steps that go into cooking in the back kitchen, which, of course, is where my primary focus would be. But that's absolutely true. That said, I do have to say that I began to feel that the chef culture, if you'll accept that there is such a thing, starting back in the 90s, got a little bit off track when there were a lot of books out that were touting the pursuit of excellence as some abstract goal, which sounds great and certainly was, codified by the professional schools, which changed restaurant culture dramatically over the last 40 or 50 years. But I just found that kind of odd, as if there is one standard for perfection in a world where we're dealing with natural products, products of nature. So trying to find perfection in that natural realm strikes me as problematic, at least.
I'm probably taking this way in the wrong direction for right before our first break, but it reminds me something that sort of bothered me for a long time, and I don't know if this is American culture or international culture, is always having to find the best, whether you're trying to find the best restaurant or I'm going to go see a movie. What is the best movie that's out right now? What is the best city to visit? What's the best view in Acadia National Park? And why are we so obsessed with this best?
When it's only dinner.
Yeah, and the problem with the best, besides being a moving target, is that it takes you out of the present tense, and it takes you out of the experience that you're currently having, and it is such an American obsession with the best, or to be thinking, maybe I should be at another table in this restaurant, maybe this isn't the best one, maybe this isn't the place to be on a Friday night. It's almost like an illness. But I do think that on the other side of that are people that come back to kind of like the simple enjoyment of wherever they happen to be. Or as it goes with restaurants, just the enjoyment of the fact that someone is waiting on you and someone has prepared food for you and you don't have to do the dishes and you get to watch service unfold. And it is theater, as Kate was saying. Yeah, the best thing is so interesting.
Well, we do have to take a break. We'd love for you to join the conversation, whether you have worked in one of these restaurants, whether you've read Stephanie Dandler's book, whether you are just a lover of fine dining. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Roosevelt Campobello International Park. Discover the new Adventure Center, gateway to hikes, bikes, and drives, fdr.net, and Maine Federation of Farmers Markets. Maine has farmers markets every day of the week. Locate one near you at mainefarmersmarkets.org.
Next week, Republicans will convene in Cleveland to nominate Donald Trump for president. NPR and PBS NewsHour will be there, too. We're teaming up to bring you live coverage each night. I'm Rachel Martin. Join me, Judy Woodruff, and Gwen Ifill for speeches, interviews, and analysis live from the Republican National Convention. Special coverage from PBS NewsHour and NPR News.
Join us for full coverage Monday through Thursday evening next week, starting at 8 o'clock on both Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Television. Maine International Film Festival is here, featuring 100 films and 50 filmmakers. The event takes place in Waterville through this Sunday. Screening venues include the Railroad Square Cinema, the Waterville Opera House, and Common Street Arts in Waterville. MPBN members, once again, receive a special discount. Visit mpbn.net. Click on events for all of the details.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the world of high-end restaurants. Joining me from New York City, Stephanie Dandler, the author of Sweet Bitter, one of the big breakout novels of the summer. With me in the studio, Sam Hayward, acclaimed chef and restaurateur, and Kate Christensen, food writer and author of several novels. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start in Stark and Carol. Hi, Carol. Go ahead.
Hi. I called in because I had something happen when I was a teenager, and that was in Catholic school. Somewhere along the line, I was given this book to read, and it was telling me, as I remember now, I'm in my early 70s, this was when I was 14 or 15, that being very picky and kind of elitist about food was actually, in a Catholic tradition, a form of gluttony. That it was being so picky and demanding that it was really almost in the area of sin. And I remember being very impressed with this idea. And out of it, I took this idea that I should always be grateful, both for wonderful, beautiful, gorgeous meals, as well as for the most common Kraft macaroni and cheese that I might be lucky enough to have my partner give me for dinner some particular night. So it's not to disparage fine dining, but to realize that it's just lucky.
Right. And you know, Carol, it's funny. Tangentially, you're talking about something we've been talking about during break, is the sort of the sense of entitlement that some people have in this world, and contrasting that with a sense of gratitude for this embarrassment of riches, especially those of us in Maine have, surrounded by these. Yesterday's program on Maine Calling was about small farms and, you know, this incredible seafood, and really, I guess, perspective is what sometimes we need.
I like the caller's comment, in part because, if I can borrow your term, Kate, here we are in the northeast corner of New Hampshire and Maine. And we have, not only do we have a strong Catholic background here, but we also have those Puritans in our background. And we like to think that the Puritans had this sort of anti-Epicurean attitude, that pleasure and sensuality were to be avoided, and that's probably not true. I have a feeling that, and I've read before, that if the Puritans had a chance and had the resources, they would have been eating much more glamorously than we think they did. So I'm not sure that that's totally accurate, but there is that attitude in our culture, underlying our culture here in New England.
And what struck me in your novel, Stephanie Dandler, is there's sort of there's some morality. The characters in your novel, whether it's someone who's an expert in wine or whether it's somebody who's an expert in service, there's a bit of this sort of personal morality in everyday actions, every movement, every choice.
Yes, that's very true. And there's also, running through the whole novel, this lesson of gratitude, which the caller just mentioned. And there are several scenes where Tess, who's quite young and 22 and self-absorbed, as some of us were at that age, where she has to be reminded that she's talking about gifts. She's talking about uni, sea urchin, and a seafood tower, or these oysters, and that food is never something to be blasé about or to take for granted.
Carol, thanks so much for your call. The New York Times review of Stephanie's book, among other things, mentioned the idea that busboys these days have more in common with the class they serve than ever before, and that restaurants are now, quote, the turf of those on their way in or out of graduate school. Sam Hayward, is this your experience? Do you find that the longer you've been in this industry, the more people who are very highly educated are coming in to even the most menial jobs in the restaurant industry?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting phenomenon. Back in the 80s, we used to laugh at the restaurant that I was operating in Brunswick, that we had more master's degrees on the service staff than you could imagine. It was very funny to me. That is happening, and in part because, especially working on the floor in restaurants, in the front of the house, you have opportunities to have a schedule that allows you to have a completely different life that's financed by working in the restaurant business. So we have people who are artists showing in galleries. We have people on their way to becoming actors and actresses. We have people getting their teaching certificates, doing many, many other things besides working in the restaurant. But they make enough money in very short hours, relatively speaking, that allows them to have that other life.
Stephanie, that kind of happened to you. You were an aspiring writer and a waitress, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I had been working in restaurants since I was 15, but I knew that it was a safe space for artists. And I knew that it was a place where the time-to-money ratio would always be in my favor and allow me to have this other life. And I think that it's not a coincidence that the job market for millennials coming out of college collapsed. And here are these jobs that pay incredibly well and give you a very good quality of life, at least if you can keep it from becoming too nocturnal. And so you see more and more, especially in Brooklyn and New York, people coming from Ivy League schools and saying, I'm going to become a mixologist, which is just something I never could have imagined. I really think that even in 2006, when I got to the city, there was still a little bit of like, if you were here, you may have failed at something else. There was still a little bit like, is this a trap? And I think that's completely gone. It seems to be a rite of passage now, especially in the city. I don't know if what's going on in Maine, but I would assume it's similar.
And Kate, that was your story, right? You were an aspiring writer also waiting tables, maybe not at the same kind of restaurant.
Well, I actually only waited tables for a very brief time. I was one of the secretaries, and that's another thing that when I was in New York coming up, I moved there in 1989 and lived there through the 90s, which was the age of swaps and derivatives. So I was a secretary in the World Trade Center, making a really good living and working on my novel. But I was thinking just now when you were talking about waiters, how there used to be a class. It used to be like a career. You would be a career waiter. They wore uniforms. I think they had sort of a creed amongst themselves. And there was a sense of waiting tables as something you did. And and now, I mean, the joke when I lived in New York, especially in Williamsburg, was that waiting was waiting for your real life while you waited tables. And there was a kind of snootiness among the wait staff that they would deign to come in and pay attention to our, I mean, it was very hipstery. And very sort of part of the mystique of eating out in Williamsburg was like getting your waitress to respect you.
Well, but you talk about that a little bit, Stephanie, about the disdain, you know, the sort of tension between how many in your novel, maybe not you and the people you know personally, the tension between the wonderful way they treat their customers, but in many cases the disdain they have for them personally.
I think that there's a very fine balance. And I think that a lot of the times the other story is true where the guest is ignoring the server and the server has an expertise and really is an ambassador of a certain experience that you have signed up for by stepping into the restaurant. But a diner or a guest will come in and want their experience. They will want the wine that they know. They're not really open. And of course, that's very frustrating, especially if you take a lot of pride in being a trained food professional. However, what Kate was talking about in Williamsburg, I mean, that's terrible service, that sort of disconnect and those bored servers. Nothing makes me crazier than looking and seeing a server that's so bored and can't make eye contact.
That's why I liked what you said about the 51%, and about how there is a way to wait tables and to be educated and to this. I love that about your book. That moment when Tess is talking about wine and there's the woman who she's under who doesn't know as much as she does. And Tess has this realization that she has actually mastered. She's mastering wine. And it's what you were saying about knowing so much. And this is true of art forms also. The idea is to master the rules and master the knowledge so that you can then fall back from that. So it doesn't give way to snobbery. It gives way to a kind of relaxed joy and pride in your work that I think is what this book is about. And I think that waiting tables can arrive at that. The restaurants I'm talking about were not fine dining restaurants by any means.
I know exactly which restaurants you're talking about. I like know what corner they are on.
I'm going to go up to Gene, who's calling from New Harbor. Hi, Gene. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to mention a little item about back when I used to work in Washington, D.C., and in the late 60s, there were a few high-end restaurants. And one of the things that always was true was that each restaurant seemed to have its own special person who ate there off the hill. And the place I used to like to take my clients was a place called the Salle du Bois, and that's because Everett Dirksen ate there for lunch. And so I would take my clients in, and we would sit down. I'd make sure they were facing Everett, and I'd be facing them. And then they'd look for a while, and then they'd finally say, "Do you know, I believe that's Everett Dirksen over there."
That's a great story, Gene. Thanks for sharing. We have an email from Bonnie in Brunswick. She writes, "What's the trend of servers asking, how is everything tasting? Is that the only measure of a good meal? What happened to the general, how is everything? So that the customer may be allowed to say, great. But could I have more water, please, for example?" Sam, I'll let you respond to that. Do you tell your servers what to say? Or
no, we rely on them. They're all really smart people, or they wouldn't be there. Wait a minute, what am I saying? I think I got that backwards. No, they're really intelligent people and know how to communicate and make contact with their guests. But they have to come up with their own ways that feel comfortable for them and feel authentic and sincere, where they can explain to people what their expectations really could be. By the way, if I could just say, some people come in from, especially from away, not understanding that Maine is this unique place with its own foods, and expect you to sort of fit a meal into the mold that they may be used to from, you know, Daniel Boulud in New York, and will tell you, this is how I want my meal. To which we all often have to say is, if you want those kinds of substitutions, A, it's going to take longer. B, other people in the restaurant are going to suffer. And C, you're not going to enjoy it so much because that's not what we do. So give us a chance to do it our way, and you'll have a better chance of enjoying the food. But we'll stay in touch.
We're going to go to Matt, who's calling from Castine. Hi, Matt. Go ahead.
Hi there. How are you doing today? Thank you for taking my call. So I'm a relatively young chef. I've only been in the industry for about 8 years. I'm a traveling chef. I've been all over the country, and I've always asked this one question of all chefs that I get a chance to speak to, and that is that there's this great democratization of food now with the advent of the Food Network, Cooking Channel, Yelp, things along those lines, where everybody's getting an opportunity to experience fine dining that was once only for the elite. Now, the other side of it, and you guys mentioned earlier, is the issue that comes along with sites like Yelp and Google reviews. How do we, as chefs and as servers and people of the industry, how do we take the power back from Yelp and give it to those respected food critics?
That's a huge question.
Stop reading Yelp.
Yeah, and that is what I used to tell my servers and my chef when I was managing, is don't give it your energy. I mean, that's all you can do. And the people that know are still the people that know, I think. Food critics are still they're still thriving, and they're still authorities to in this culture, I think. I don't think Yelp has robbed them completely, but you can't read it, can't participate.
I think of it as analogous to Amazon reader reviews for a novelist.
Absolutely.
And it just
I didn't
seems
know
like,
this.
Oh, it's awful.
Until recently.
No, stay away. Just stay away from that and stay away from Yelp. I feel like it's giving people the power to make manifest what used to take place in the privacy of your house or your car, and you would be talking to your spouse or your friend, you know, griping about the meal. And now you actually have the power to hurt a writer or hurt a chef if you had a bad experience with it. And I don't know. I think it's a very good question. I don't have any answers, just
yeah.
Empathy.
Matt, thanks for your call. On that note, we do have to take another break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Condo Furniture by Endicott Home, offering sleeper sofas for smaller spaces to accommodate summer guests. Learn more at condofurniture.com. And Casella, committed to boosting recycling rates statewide through its One Bin, Zero Sort program. Casella, giving resources new life.
Climate One is changing the conversation about energy, economy, and the environment. Our next program explores two very different approaches to the climate change debate. One uses misinformation to question the science in order to support continued drilling. The other is literally jumping off bridges to stop those drilling rigs from operating. Deception and defiance on the next Climate One with Greg Dalton.
Join us this afternoon at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
The hit TV show Unreal takes place behind the scenes at a fictional reality TV show.
And this week, Unreal star Shiri Appleby also directs.
The actress directing the character that is playing the producer producing the television show.
I'm confused.
No, you're Rico Galliano.
Oh.
And I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
Thank you.
Join us, Shiri, and Inside Amy Schumer creator Jesse Klein this week on the Dinner Party Download. You're welcome.
Coming up tomorrow evening at midnight here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're talking about why the book Sweet Bitter is resonating with so many people, and we're talking about the restaurant industry. Joining me on the line, Stephanie Dandler. She is the author of Sweet Bitter, a novel that's really hit all the bestseller lists this summer. With me in the studio, Kate Christensen, Maine-based writer, and Sam Hayward, the chef and Maine restaurant pioneer. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Sam, I have a close friend who works in the restaurant industry in New York, and she has a husband who's a chef and owns a restaurant. And one of the things she's complained to me about recently is that the industry in New York is changing because so many young chefs and young experts are not going to New York. It used to be that you had to go to New York to cut your teeth and make your name, and now they're going to places like Portland, Maine. Are you seeing that? Are you seeing a crop of young people that you might not have seen a decade ago?
Well, right now, the labor market is so tight that we're not seeing anybody. But it really is very tight. But yes, we've gone through cycles. When we get applications from all the major cooking schools and from young people who worked in San Francisco and New York and Boston and elsewhere who want to come to Maine for what this has to offer, and one of those is what we refer to as the farm-to-table movement, which has really consolidated here in Maine in a major way, and they want to be part of that. And some of them end up actually leaving the restaurant business and going to the farms to work. That's another fascinating phenomenon that we've seen over the last decade or so that's welcome.
Stephanie, the protagonist in your novel, Tess, the young woman, for her, everything is brand new. Everything from the kinds of vegetables she sees in the market to the wine and things like that. It seems to me as though your protagonist in the near future may not even exist because sort of this food culture is even hitting small town America.
No, she definitely no longer really exists. The farm-to-table movement has been so far-reaching that the thought that I personally could have gone 22 years without having an heirloom tomato, that doesn't really exist anymore. And I was recently in Southeast Asia, and I had been there 6 years before, and I saw all these 20-year-old backpackers that are normally, like, eating fast food. they know everything. They know about the street food and they know about turmeric and they know the differences between curries. It's totally changed this. And I think it has something to do with reality television. I don't watch any of that stuff, but I feel like it has spread the food culture globally.
And Kate, tell me about who is the audience for your food writing? Who do you hear from? What do you know?
The audience, I'm not really sure who I'm writing
me.
For.
Me. I'm sorry. I read the blog even before the book.
Really?
I'm the audience. Yeah, of course.
Oh, that's
my God.
So nice. I feel like I write about food as a sort of offshoot of writing fiction. And it's sort of like food burst out of my fiction. I put as much food as I can into my fiction because I think it says so much about characters and it says so much about culture and who we are, how we eat, what we eat, how we feel about eating, how we act at a table. And I feel like food to me is complicated and I have a lot of contradictory feelings about it and I haven't resolved them. So I feel like for me, writing about food is a way to explore what it is. And it's in this country, it's become so, in a way, so political and so charged. And so, you know, people really get riled up about food, as you know, in the restaurant industry. And people get riled up about food writing. And there's a kind of political correctness. And there's a lot of sort of passion around it. And I feel like I'm just writing for people who like to read about food and who want to talk about it in some way and sort of explore what it is in this country right now. Because it's one of the most interesting things, I think, that's going on in this country and in Maine, for sure.
Well, if I could just touch on that a little bit, it's politicized as well. And in some ways, I think that's legitimate. Here in Maine, for example, and you've written about it in your own book, Kate, the Gulf of Maine is a fraction of the productivity that it once had in terms of seafood. And we deal with that every day in my business. And the changes in my own professional career starting in 74 are astonishing and heartbreaking. So the only way that we really have to deal with that is in the political sphere. We can't really tell customers coming into Maine that fish and chips can't have cod because there isn't any cod. They have certain expectations, and we have to deal with all of those cultural and political issues. So that's one of the reasons why in Maine it's particularly fraught for me, and we work through it every day.
We're going to go to Charlie, who's calling from North Berwick. Hi, Charlie. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you? Yeah, I been in the as a chef for nearly 30 years, and now I teach culinary arts at York County Community College. And one of the, you know, you referred to the Food Network, and for me, it's kind of a double-edged sword where, yes, it's exposed people to a lot of different things, but then I have students coming in who have this impression that that food is a competition, and I, you know, it's really important to impart on them the concept of it as being a profession and that you're working with colleagues in a restaurant setting. And, you know, I'm really looking, I'm going to pick up your book and read it because I want to see, you know, how you address that.
Thoughts, Stephanie?
Yeah, I agree that television has changed people's relationship to food and to thinking that they can be a chef and probably led to a lot of people thinking that there's an easy mastery of an endlessly complex subject. You will see when you read the novel that I'm a fan of kind of the more classical education. I really do think that cooking is a craft and an art, and I think that serving is a craft and an art, and I don't think you can pick it up, and I think it has to be taken seriously. So, yeah, I agree with you.
Charlie, thanks for your call. And, you know, it's interesting because you mentioned colleagues, and Stephanie, in your novel, and I'm going to ask Sam if he agrees with this, the colleagues really kind of become family. Do you find that your restaurant?
No question about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that restaurants are immediate family, and I have those family members from all of the places I've worked, and you're bonded in such a superficial way in a lot of ways. You work together. Sometimes you don't know their last name or their life story, but you are bonded forever with this shared experience, I find. And I'm sure it's true at your restaurant, Sam.
Yeah, it is. And I think one of the things that maybe people outside the business have an inkling of from TV and other books is that it's a kind of a pressure cooker environment. And your book, Stephanie, really dwells on some of the complexities of that. And I sometimes feel that because I had some years before I became a cook on the road as a sideman in rock bands, that the restaurant business had nothing to teach me about extremes of human behavior. I felt like I'd seen enough of that in the past. But that really does happen in that really tight combat zone kind of environment. It can get very intense. And that means both solidifying relationships and tearing them apart.
As someone who has been a waitress myself, and not in the kind of restaurants that we're talking about here again, Kate, but I often say everyone needs to do it once. Everyone needs to have that experience. It will change the way you live your life going forward. And perhaps you can substitute retail in there too, but to have that everyday experience facing one-on-one, the good and bad in humanity.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I think that there's so much to be learned about food and wine and the senses, but really I think what you gain with the education in restaurants is empathy. That is the muscle that you are flexing over and over again during service, and you can take that with you anywhere. I totally agree. Everyone should do it.
It serves you very well as a novelist.
mean, two of yeah, you can say
it's endless, really. You can, it's yeah, the things you overhear, the dialogue, it's you can pull from it forever.
We're going to go to Buxton and Galen. Hi, Galen, go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Great.
I was just hoping that Sam could touch on some of the advocacy work he's been doing in the restaurant with connecting food and farmers with tangible tables.
Okay, go ahead. And, you know, yesterday's Main Calling program was on small farming and getting into that. So it's so interconnected.
It is. I'm not sure how directly I do that. It's very important to me to give credit to people who supply us with the food. But on the other hand, we don't necessarily try to put brands or individual farm names on our menu. But I guarantee you, every server knows where virtually every bite on today's menu happened to come from and who produced it. And in many cases, they've taken field trips to see the farms and other aspects. But we believe really strongly on that in that. And I personally spent, I think, 14 years on the MOFCA board trying to help steer farms and support farms in directions that I thought were good for all of us. I believe really strongly in it, but I'm only one person.
We'll go to Tony, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Hi. I was kind of curious to know where the vegan demand is trending within the restaurant community. And it often seems as though they're offering one, maybe two selections as an accommodation, but certainly not where the plant-based whole food movement seems to be going.
And all right, Tony. And Sam, I think it depends on the restaurant, really, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, there are restaurants that are able to offer easily vegan and vegetarian options, and we certainly have them. It's a very complex question, and one of the things that plays into it is that you could spend a lot of effort and money preparing for vegan or vegetarian items and go 3 or 4 days and nobody orders one.
Mm.
So that really is one of the issues, that how you make that all work. The other thing is that in 4 Street's experience, it's fascinating to me that there are a number of vegan items that would be considered small plates that anybody could put together a really good and complete menu out of. But because they don't see a main course, a big 12-inch plate piled up with vegan items, they're offended that they didn't have that option. And many of us will make a full meal at a place like 4th Street by ordering a bunch of appetizer plates. But so from that perspective, it's interesting that there are people who decline to order a vegetarian or vegan menu from small plates, but take offense that we don't have a big main course.
Mm. Tony, thanks for your call. Move to Constantino, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Constantino.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Well, my question is to the author, and it sounds like a fascinating book, and I'm going to read it. But is it more than Kitchen Confidential written through female eyes?
I hope so. I intended it to be more, certainly. I love that book, and it's a benchmark, but I was working consciously against it. And it's not just that the protagonist is a woman, but it's the way in which she experiences the world. We saw a proliferation of this kind of like aggressive, testosterone-driven back of house, that's the chef, view on restaurants. And so I really wanted to do something a little bit more delicate and a little bit more like quotidian, just focusing on the folding of the napkins or the polishing of the glasses or the little tastes that occur. It also has a lot to do with New York City in a way that I don't know that Kitchen Confidential quite did. It's multifaceted, so I do think there's something there beyond the restaurant aspect.
I would say that you're not writing an expose at all of the restaurant industry. Also,
yeah,
you're writing
I had
a
no
story.
Intention to.
It's a story, yeah. But it's a coming of age story that takes place in a restaurant, which is a very different thing, I think.
There isn't much left to expose, to be honest. I mean, that's what we're talking about in the show is that the information is already everywhere.
Right.
When Kitchen Confidential came out, that was like 16 years ago or something crazy.
Yeah. Well, believe it or not, we're out of time. It's been so wonderful talking with the three of you. Such a great topic. And the book is Sweet Bitter. It is a best-selling novel about coming of age while working in a New York restaurant. Stephanie Dandler, the author, thank you so much for joining us today on Maine Calling. Kate Christensen, a Maine-based author of several books, including Blue Plate Special and How to Cook a Moose. Is there moose on the menu ever at 4th Street, Sam?
No, I'm afraid not. We're not allowed to serve shot game.
Sam Hayward, of course, award-winning chef and co-owner of the Portland restaurants 4th Street and Scales. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Blair Legere answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join host Keith Shortall for a conversation about citizen science, how volunteers are helping scientists gather data that they'd never be able to do on their own. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.
Stephanie, pleasure.
The world is in Cleveland with one Englishman.
First time I've ever seen the U.S. presidential election process up close.
And one American.
I'm an immigrant. I was born in Peru, and I've grown up in the States.
Covering the convention.
It's going to be so interesting watching people wrestle with that question. What does it mean to be American?
I want to know how they interpret Americanness. Yeah.
Unconventional convention coverage on the world.
Coming up this afternoon at 3 o'clock.
I'm Josh Block, in for Brent Banbury. Millions of people are taking to the streets to play the augmented reality.